and it's Reel 2. So here you were in forestry, and mainly with roads and drains, is that right? Your jobs?
Yes, we were a road gang, and we were concerned with breaking stones to make hardcore and building roads into the forest rather than the actual growing and care of trees, which some of the other forestry sections do.
And how long would you have been doing that, do you think, Roger?
Not very long, about 6 weeks in all. Partly because I think a vacancy arose somewhere else, which it was decided I was appropriate to fill.
So was that with relief that you went off to something else?
It was with relief, and it was to relief, because I went off to the to work for the Oxford Committee for Famine Relief.
Could you tell me what that was? What was the Oxford Committee for Famine Relief?
Well, the Oxford Committee for Famine Relief had been set up, I think, in the 40s, and was intended really to, first of all, to cope with problems in Europe. It later became a great deal more international. But it was a fairly small organisation then. It wasn't, incidentally, known as Oxfam. Oxfam was no more than the telegraphic address. But it operated really in quite small premises, the gift shop in Broad Street, Oxford, and some rented offices round the corner in Corn Market, just above Carfax. And we were general Dog Spotters office staff. Those of us who worked in the Corn Market offices were responsible for organising a rota for the volunteers, and of course, like many charities, the Oxford Committee for Famine Relief was very dependent on volunteers. It was also very dependent on its index of people who had given money or goods to the charity, and regular appeals went out to people who had previously given. This is quite common in charities. It meant that their address list was perhaps their most valuable asset. And there it was in offices which were, to say the least, a fire risk. So the volunteers were mainly concerned in writing out a duplicate card index, an enormously laborious job, because all the cards were handwritten, and the gallant ladies from North Oxford would come in and sit down to write a batch of another 100 cards, which could then be put into a duplicate index, which could be kept elsewhere.
And you say this was mainly Europe still, was it, in the 1950s when you were there?
Yes. I don't think... at that stage, the Oxford Committee was sending stuff really internationally, but they had a very big business sending clothes and goods to Europe. And, of course, the other thing in Oxford was obviously the gift shop and the receipt and valuing of goods sent in for sale in the gift shop.
Mm-hmm. Would they have been at that stage second-hand goods, or were they, as they do today, bringing in, you know, stuff from abroad?
Oh, at that stage it was all second-hand, results of house clearances, this kind of thing. Sometimes the clothing was totally useless, and when I later worked for the Oxford Committee in London at a church hall in Pimlico Road, St Barnabas Church Hall, I remember particularly that we received a lot of shoes. Now, shoes, unless they're in very good condition, are not much use second-hand, and a lot of useless shoes would accumulate at the back of this church hall in a vast, untidy mountain until they could be taken away in a skip and bus.
Who were the leading lights at that time? In I'll call it Oxfam, you know, this early.
The general secretary or director of Oxfam was Leslie Kirkley, the first the director of Oxfam, who was assisted by Alan Ross, I think it was, and in the gift shop by Joe Mickey, who was really quite a good shop manager. Apart from that, it was a very small outfit, and we would sit round the table in the morning opening the mail, I can still remember the excitement when somebody got a really large cheque in their particular pile of envelopes.
But what was the secret of their success, do you think, when you look back to that time? You know, because it was post-war austerity still, wasn't it, 53, 55, perhaps beginning, the country was picking itself up. But, you know, obviously Oxfam has grown so much since those early days, hasn't it?
It has grown a lot. Yes. In fact, on my second stint at Oxfam, I remember being sent to look at various properties which were a possibility for them to move into on a more permanent basis. Most of these were in the slum area of Oxford, near the St. Ebbs. Of course, in the end, they went to Banbury Road in North Oxford, which was altogether better address. But in those days, I think the main success of Oxfam was the fact that it trimmed its operation so much that nearly everything that was given went into relief. And it developed a reputation for this, so that people felt if they were giving money to Oxfam, it really was being used. And they gave a lot of money. And I remember, for instance, going to get really quite voluminous receipt books, because every donation had a receipt personally signed by the treasurer, who was a retired colonial civil servant called Sir Alan Pym, who lived on Headington Hill, and I had to take out empty books of receipts and bring them back signed. Fortunately, his name was fairly short.
Did they have workers in the field at that stage, Oxfam, or were they mainly back at the base in Oxford?
I think at that stage they worked through other agencies that were overseas. They certainly didn't have anything like the network they have today.
And so you were there how long altogether, Roger?
Well, I had two, as I say, two main stints with Oxfam in Oxford. One of them was actually just after I'd formally finished my national service. And I also had about 5 or 6 weeks of working in London, living in a hostel in just off Ladbroke Grove, and working in the big warehouse, Pimlico, where stuff was bailed up for shipping out by Davis Turner.
So after Oxfam, what was your experience? You seem to have done quite a variety of jobs already. And I wonder what you did after Oxfam.
After Oxfam, immediately after the time in Oxford, I went to do my 6 months of hospital work. This was in 1954. And I did that at a tuberculosis hospital in Malvern Wells.
Would this have been usual for the international service to have gone into hospitals?
Yes, I think everybody did spend some time in hospitals, and usually that was a minimum of 6 months, but it could be much longer, particularly if you found yourself suited to the work. I spent 6 months there. I didn't actually greatly enjoy the hospital work, and indeed it really was quite hard, and also to some people a little upsetting. People with tuberculosis, particularly pulmonary tuberculosis, needed coughing, so you had to hold them front and back to prevent them splitting open if they'd had surgery. Some of them were really quite ill, but they'd never told many of them never realised how ill they were. And this was what I think Thomas Mann called the hope of the bicycle. And it was something that I'd come across in Thomas Mann. I never really appreciated until I went to work at St. Wollstone's. But against that, of course, to work in Malvern Wells was really very enjoyable. It was a lovely place. It was close to Worcester, where the Three Choirs Festival was being held that year. And so there were many compensations to working there. Mm-hmm.
How were you treated by the hospital staff? You know, did they know that your status as COs, as it were?
They certainly knew our status. The hospital had to accept that if they wanted to keep up their complement of orderlies, and orderlies were so poorly paid and their conditions of service were so poor that it wasn't really a question of being able to easily replace the personnel that were supplied by the international service. So I think we were welcome in that regard. It's interesting that at St. Wollstone's, one of the charge nurses was in fact a Quaker, but this was just a coincidence. However, it may have meant that the matron was well aware of their Quakers and their beliefs.
But did you ever suffer any hostility, you know, because you were COs through all this time that you've been, you know?
I don't think so. I suppose some of the patients may have inquired as to how we came to be there, but normally we were just part of the hospital staff, as far as they were concerned. The ones that wore brown coats rather than the ones that wore white coats.
Do you think this was different because it wasn't a war? You know, that you were there in peacetime, as it were, covering your national service, rather than actually not being part of a war?
I think there was very little feeling or resentment against conscientious objectors at that time in the early 50s. I certainly didn't come across anything of that sort in either forestry work or hospital work, which are the two areas where I suppose that might have occurred.
Was that useful for you, you know, to have had that hospital experience, do you think? You know, to have 6 months working in a hospital.
I think it was, yes. Partly because it earned money for the international service. As I say, the hospital sections at one time were providing nearly two-thirds of the total income. So there was that way of looking at it. The other thing was the way it put us in touch with people of all walks of life who were in the hospital because of their medical condition. And tuberculosis is an indiscriminate sort of disease. There were actually doctors in the hospital, doctors of philosophy as well as medical doctors. And there were people, you know, from much humbler backgrounds. I can remember, for instance, on one of the wards I worked on, there was actually a radio actor who, the man who created the part of Jack Archer in The Archers. He suffered from tuberculosis, poor chap, and spent some time between recording episodes of The Archers in Birmingham at St. Wollstone's.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the treatment at that time? You know, had there been that breakthrough yet in the treatment of TB?
The breakthrough in the treatment of TB was just beginning at that stage, and drugs like PAS were just coming in. But mainly the treatment was still surgery where this was possible, and of course surgery meant that patients had to build up their strength to undergo surgery, and then they had a long recovery period afterwards. So there were a lot of long-term patients at St. Wollstone's. It was customary in the unit to have a series of injections, cabs, when you joined, which would cover the sort of service you were going to do, anti-tetanus because of the forestry work, new BCG injections against tuberculosis and various other diseases that you might encounter on work overseas.
So after the hospitals, you were hoping to go abroad, weren't you? Did you get any, were possibilities appearing?
Some possibilities were appearing because in 1954, which was the sort of main year of my time in the international service, people were going to Holland for flood work and to Greece following the earthquakes there.
Yes, what was happening in Holland, first of all, with the floods?
In Holland, well, the floods had been in 1953. The early work in Holland was mainly done by the Dutch. And later on, I think, they found it helpful to have sections from the unit over there to assist in reconstruction work. And the pattern was rather similar in the Ionian Islands because the earthquake took place in the summer of 1953, and the first sections didn't go to Greece until the beginning of the following year. But there the devastation was so total that there was an enormous reconstruction job, mainly revolving around prefabricated buildings donated often by the Scandinavian countries. I would have liked to have gone to Greece, I think, at the time. I didn't know quite what the conditions were out there. And afterwards, I thought perhaps I was lucky not to have gone, because nearly everybody who went to Greece suffered from jaundice and one or two cases of amoebic dysentery. One poor chap even had to be flown back because he developed polio, which fortunately was detected early enough for him not to be more severely ill than he was.
I suppose one of those islands would have been Cephalonia, is that right?
Yes, that was the main island that they started on, was Cephalonia. Argos Stoli was the main port at which supplies for the islands were received. And although I'm not an expert on what happened there, there were clearly all the usual problems of doing anything in Greece because of the difficulties of negotiating with the local organisations.
Go overseas, Roger.
Well, my overseas experience started with a rather curious episode in the winter and spring of 1955. Those of us who were received instructions to go to Germany were told to catch the boat train from Liverpool Street to Harwich, cross the Hook of Holland, and proceed by train to Bremen. So we would get further directions, and this we did. It was very bad weather, sea crossing was rough, the Low Countries landscape was very bleak and unwelcoming. And when we got to Bremen, there were no instructions. So there was some frantic telephoning, which eventually established that we were to make our way to Delmenhorst. This is a town in North Saxony. Smells very strongly of the linoleum that its major industry. And there at last we were met by our German hosts, who told us we were off to a briefing seminar at a place called Steinkimmen, which wasn't far out of Delmenhorst, but as soon as we got there the snow came down so heavily that we were really completely isolated. And in fact, that rather extended the seminar over the few days that had been intended. The other thing that extended the seminar was the fact that it was an international business. There were people there from France, Italy, all over the place, and the main languages were German, English and French. But I remember that one of the Italians spoke none of these languages, so his contributions had to be translated by a colleague of his who knew enough French. What the seminar was intended to do was to give us some insight into the refugee situation in Germany. And at this stage, of course, many of the refugees were still crossing from the east to the west and creating considerable problems in a country that was still struggling to recover from the damage inflicted during the Second World War. Much of the discussion was fairly meaningless, and to those of us without much knowledge of Europe at all, I don't think it did actually a lot of good. The Germans who were conducting the business were mainly students anyway, so they were very earnest, but I don't think all that practical, and this was something that was to crop up later. From Steinkimmen, I was sent to Hanover, and the project there was work in a suburb of Hanover called Missburg, where a large empty site was being turned into a camp for refugees, a hutted camp. And this Jugendwerksiedlung, as it was known, consisted of our small international group, a number of German students, and a number of refugees who were brought in partly so that they would have the contact with the international group and partly to take part in the work. The the Germans were, as I say, were very earnest, but they didn't seem to be all that keen on the manual work. In fact, the manual work didn't start immediately because the winter was so hard that the ground on the site was absolutely impossible to break open. And when a thaw arrived, it meant that the whole site became a morass, and the lorries that turned up to deliver the hardcore either stuck in the mud or dumped their loads, which sank immediately. It was at this point that the FAU experience of those of us who worked on forestry roads came to the fore, and we were able to show how it was necessary to dig diagonal drains and build a road into the heart of the site so that the lorries could get in there, which I think impressed the other people working at the camp. The other thing I ought to say about the camp at Hanover Missburg is that we had some contact with young Germans in the city through the Jugendhaus in the centre of the city. We were invited into some homes, which was very good and helped those of us who could speak any German to develop it a little bit. Also, it was a welcome relief from the conditions on the site itself, where we lived in very rudimentary huts. The diet was extremely poor, so poor, in fact, that over a period when I was section leader, some of the chaps fell quite ill with diseases that were really only due to the diet. There was no meat. The soup was mainly vegetables, beans, a lot of bread, and margarine, but no fruit.
Yes, this would have been, nearly 9 years after the war, wasn't it? What was the state of Hamburg generally then?
This was Hanover.
Hanover, beg your pardon.
Hanover was very badly damaged. and the centre of the city was really almost flattened. There were one or two new buildings, including a rather splendid new theatre, Avi Theatre, where I remember going to hear La Scala Company in Rigoletto. So that was a rare treat. But the suburbs were really fairly dull, ordinary German architecture, and we were right at the end of the tram line, Buchholzstrasse Endstation. Yes, we were conscious of that. And the other interesting thing, really, about the whole of this work was the contact with the refugees. The refugees were a very hard-bitten lot, seemed to us altogether more suited to the situation we found ourselves in than, for instance, the German students. The refugees knew how to get things. They had honed their skills of survival. And it was a very curious situation because, in fact, we were the refugees. We didn't know how to cope. They did. And they could get all sorts of things if you made it worth their while. So this was a bit of an eye-opener for some of us, and took a bit of getting used to.
Where would they have come? You say they came from the East, the refugees. So which countries would they have, what nationalities would they have been?
They were mainly German, but there were some from German-speaking communities further east, because, of course, there were substantial groups of Germans beyond the borders of what was then becoming East Germany.
Did you have any Jewish refugees? Were any of them Jewish?
I don't think there were any Jewish people on our section. There were in the unit as a whole, but I don't remember that coming up at all on this particular section in Hanover. One of the things our German host did for us was to try and give us a little insight into the way that Germany was recovering from the effects of the war. So we went, for instance, to the Bowls and Biscuit Factory to witness the birth of the Leibniz cake. And in fact, we were given huge quantities of Leibniz cakes without anything to drink. We also went to Hanemag's Tractor Factory and to Continental Tires, and even went as far as Wolfsburg, which was out beyond Brunswick, to see the enormous production line being set up to turn out Volkswagens.
But what was the fate of these refugees, you know, who were coming and going to stay in the camp that you were building? Was anyone sort of going to train them or for sort of some sort of permanent status?
I think at this stage they were still quite young, so that the prospect of employment, which obviously was going to be a problem in the future, didn't necessarily arrive. The main thing was to find them somewhere to live and a community to attach themselves to.
They would all have been young people, would they?
They were all young
people,
yes. They were all substantially younger than we, and we weren't very old.
Yes. So who would have been in charge generally of this outfit? It sounds you've got young German students, the young FAUIS, and the young refugees. Would there have been an organisation overall?
The Jugendwerksiedlung was run by Germans in Hanover. Their link with our resources was through the German student leaders, and in fact I became quite friendly with some of them. I went to visit two of them subsequently after the work in Hanover, down in Göttingen.